Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from the UK, Anna Crutchley. Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
Our topic, passementerie.
Ooh. You got it.
I got it.
Excellent, Gary. Excellent.
Yes. Okay, passementerie, which to Americans would be tassel making, but much more than tassel making. But yeah, big $100,000 French word for tassel making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but in the passementerie workshop, you get the tassel makers who are sitting at a table. You get the weavers who are working on their looms, and you get the cord spinners who are working in a long, long, long room, twisting cords. So there are those three sort of textile disciplines, crafts, which go together to form passementerie.
So when we gather together, we have three cliques then.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Okay, now you created a picture of cord makers in a room. Oh, I can just see that big long room, stuff strung all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. It's very skilled. You know, you had mentioned, and we can mention the Heritage Crafts Association Endangered Crafts List, the Red List. And which I wrote the entry for that. And because of all those crafts, the cord spinning is really the most skilled. And when you look at, let's say, antique trimmings in a grand country house or whatever, and you look at how the cords are all made, you know, suspension cords, decorative cords on top, it's incredibly detailed work. And that's the thing that unless you learn it from a master, it's going to disappear. You can't work out how to do it without being taught by hand.
Beth and I just did a podcast. We were talking about marveling over the whole pageantry of the Queen's funeral. And then just commenting all the embroidery, all the trappings, and how beautiful they are. And,
oh, they're so beautiful.
Yeah, and then, yeah, the cording and the tassels everywhere is, it's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. And it's all for show, isn't it? So when anybody asks, when we're making tassels, what are they going to be for? Well, they're not for anything. They're really, you know, it's a conceit, you know, it's for us to be able to show how rich and wealthy we are or not.
Or not, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that cord making, I can see, because I've made, you know, simple twist cords. And if you're trying to make something a little fancier, just by doing, you know, just one single twist, you have a single little hook that you're using to twist. Most people in America would know what that is. Kreinek makes one that's on a little handle, looks like a little screwdriver, like a little drill. That's the word I want. But to make something, some of the pictures the images I saw, I was like, okay, how do you make that? You know, for like the edge around a pillow, or, I mean, it was just fascinating stuff.
It is that I think in the States, I think there are a couple of companies that I know, Scalamondre, and there's another one, the name, of course, will escape me for the moment. And a lot of what they do, a lot of trimming companies do now, is use computerized machinery, which is vertical machinery, top to bottom, to spin cords. It's never as intricate and as beautiful as the handmade cords. But the cord spinners that I worked with all work in these long, long, long rooms, 30 meters long, whatever. And they stretch the threads out from one end to another and turn on a motor and then walk along these core threads, covering these core threads with good quality silk or cotton threads. It's very, very skilled work.
I can imagine.
So making those cords then, that's more active than I thought. You don't just bring some stuff together and stand at the end and let it get wrapped then. So... You're working your way through. Oh, wow.
Yeah, we all start with the yarn on spool or on cone. That's the starting point. And occasionally, even before that, if I'm doing a historical recreation or whatever, the interior decorator or the curators in the house might send me a fabric swatch, and they want the tassels to match up to the fabric colours. So it may even start with having to have the yarn especially dyed to match those colours. Not often, but we have to do that. And then once you've got that yarn back, then the next process will be the cord spinning. And then the next process will be the tassel making. And then if there is weaving as well. If it's a collection of trimmings that goes together, then the weavers will also be involved.
What portion of the work that you've done is restoration as opposed to creating new?
Half and half. I mean, the work that I do is all commissioned, so I don't do anything that's off the peg. So it's all commissioned. So some of it is for newly upholstered, might be old furniture that's being newly upholstered, and with piping cords or braids to go with and to enhance the fabric, the silks that are being used for the upholstery. And then sometimes if I'm teaching, actually, I tend to go for a more modern approach, because obviously we're not going to be using hand-dyed silks, fine filament silks. We're going to be using commercial yarns and putting together colours in an exciting way, and making tassels that you can put into any interior, into your room, hang it anywhere you want. It'll be fun and colourful.
Yeah.
Right. I've got to back you up a minute. You said, okay, so you said you had the cord makers make the cords. And then did you incorporate their cords into your tassels then?
I do. I can send you some photographs. I think that's probably the best way to do it, is to see how the cords are actually fitted in to the weaving or the tassels.
Okay. Yeah, because I just couldn't. So they've woven it, and then I know it's like the head of the tassel. So you use that, the cord in there?
With a tassel, obviously you've got the main suspension cord, the larger cords that will, let's say if it's a tie back tassel, the cords are going to enclose the curtains. So that's a thicker cord that may be, I don't know, half an inch, 5/8 of an inch. And then on the tassel itself, you might have finer cords, which you use to wrap around and decorate, maybe with a Turk's head knot, or maybe as a striping on the tassel molds, which it's all got a wooden mold on the inside.
Okay.
And then if it's a woven braid or fringe, there may well also be various sort of smaller, finer cords that are woven in as you're weaving to create a decorative edging.
So where do you get the wooden core then? Are those made for you all?
Yep, they're made especially. I've got a wonderful wood turner. He's retired now, but he will do things for me. I'm sure it's because I send him a check immediately that he's made them. the reason why he's so good is that he can create identical shapes. He can do repeated shapes. That's the most difficult thing. So he makes the exterior shape of the tassel mold. And I mean, I'm sure when he's working, he knows exactly what he's doing. But if he can't remember, he'll get this exterior shape out, if you're with me, and that will have the profile of the tassel mold that he needs to make. And quite often, if I'm doing a restoration job, I might be sent a tassel or the remains of a tassel that might be a bit bashed about, and I've got to try and guess what the wooden mold is on the inside, because it's going to be covered with cords and yarns and whatever. So I have to work out what the tassel mold looks like so that when we make the tassel, it comes out right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that takes more than one go to get it right.
Well, I did not appreciate what a multidisciplinary thing this is, because making the tassels, but then you can't make the tassels without the cords, and you can't make the tassels without the wood core.
Mm, that's right. And you start with the yarn and you start with a block of wood. Yes, yes. Oh. And you start with dyes. Yeah. It's very intricate work. It's why trimmings are so expensive. So a lot of people, if you go into a stately home and, you know, where everybody else is looking at the inside of the room, at the furniture and the furnishings, all my students are looking at the curtains. They're turned the other way because on the lead, you know, on the headers down the edge of the curtains, there'll be a braid and then they'll be tied back with tassels. And they're so intricate and they're very expensive to make. There are lots of accounts of trimmings in the, let's say, 18th century, 17th century. A householder, in a grand house would have an upholder who would come and plan the decorations. Let's say it's a state bed, and he would plan, and he would then commission the trimmings to go onto that state bed. And the trimmings might well be the most expensive part of the whole process.
Wow.
What is the history behind that? I mean, was it like a guild of trimming makers at some point, or where does the art and the origin come from on these?
First of all, I think I'm not sure about the guilds. Certainly in England, I know that there are guilds or corporations in Paris. So it's known that Louis XIV, when he moved to the Louvre or to Versailles, I forget which now, he, 1650s, he brought together button makers, lace makers, and trimmings makers into one guild, a corporation, and they produced for him. And what they produced for him, then, you know, they were never allowed to copy and produce for anybody else. Yeah. In the UK, where I trained at Brian Turner's, this was very much on the poorer side of London. And we know the Huguenot weavers used to set up on the outside of the city where there was lots of guilds and, yes, controls over the production of textiles. But I've got a feeling that the trimmings makers may have been on the outside of that. It's always been a trade. You know, because of the price of it, it comes and goes in fashion, and it comes and goes in terms of the people who are making them as well. It's a very strange form of art.
Yeah. How, well, then, all right, but then how is it that you become one of the few remaining experts in this area? What drew you to it?
What drew me to it? I've studied textiles at art school. And worked as a weaver for about 10 years, making scarves and shawls and fabric links. And one day I got a phone call from a interior decorator, a London interior decorator, asking me if I would make a lanyard. I said yes and put the phone down. And I thought, crikey, what does she mean?
Oops.
And then, oops, yes, exactly. But you know, when you're young, you're daring, aren't you? When you're older, you say no. But and then, when she got back to me 2 weeks later, they said, no, they decided they don't want a lanyard. What she meant was it was a silk sash that you would wear across the body if you're an Elizabethan gentleman and you needed to hang your sword. She said, no, they want a, they've decided what they want is a tassel. Yes, I said, put the phone down and thought, good Lord, what am I going to do? I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum and had a look through the armory to see if I could see any sword tassels. And they were very elaborate, but they didn't want me to do an elaborate one, thank goodness. I could dye the colours that they wanted, and I made a soft tassel. And then they rang up 2 weeks later and said, we've got a problem. And I thought, oh, no, it's disintegrated. and they said, no, we can't get it onto the sword. You'll have to come to the Tower of London. We'll escort you to the tower. You've got to make the tassel again on the sword. So there we go.
Holy smokes.
That was the story. indeed. So the interior decorator and the curator were looking over my shoulder as I tried with my hands shaking to make this tassel on the sword. So, and then that interior decorator gave me more jobs afterwards. That's how it all started. And then I've always been fascinated by history of textiles. And I wanted to get into, this was in the 1980s, and there were magazines like World of Interiors magazine came out, and it had some articles on trimmings, which was rather interesting because it had the price of the trimmings underneath. So that was helpful. Uh-huh. So I wrote to the trimmings makers in London and asked if I could get a placement with them. And Brian Turner very, very kindly allowed me to work in his workshop for a limited time. So, and I learned the tricks of the trade at Turner Trimmings.
Wow. So, yeah, this is clearly something where you have to go to a master to learn from. You just, difficult to pick up on your own or figure it out.
You can't pick it up on your own. It's so specialized. I think the only reason Brian gave me a job was because I could get onto the loom and weave, and his weavers were going off on holiday. So there was the reason why he said, can you weave? Yes, I said, and got onto the loom. And then I moved onto the tassel table and learned to make the tassels. So I've always been grateful to Brian.
Yeah. So your origins then are weaving. That's your entry into textiles?
Yes. And so what I'll do is that if I have to have cords done, I did for a little while have some machinery that did it, but I never learned how to make really beautiful cords. So I commission those from Brian or from another trimmings maker. And then I'll weave the fringing and make the tassels or whatever it is that's needed to be, you know, that needs to coordinate.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So you have looms and everything in your home?
Yep. I've got, it's called a ribbon loom or a trimmings loom. It's, I hadn't seen anything like it, even though I had seen a lot of looms, until I went to work for Brian. And it's a narrow loom, and it's developed. It works in a particular way that's slightly different to an ordinary weaver's loom. It's very suitable for weaving narrow fabrics on. I'll send a picture.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So in the history then, on the fringes of London then, we had businesses that were making trimmings, and it sounds to me like quite a bit of ebb and flow in terms of demand. That's got to be tough to make a living.
It's tough. Yeah, it is tough. Also, the trimmings companies I work for and other ones in London at that time, if they're making what we call specials, they're small editions of trimmings for a particular piece of furniture or a particular interior. And it can be you can get the jobs coming all through that, without a break, or you get, sometimes it's changes. When I started working in the 1980s, it was when swags and tails were very much in fashion. I don't know whether you had the same in the States, where people were very much into the recreation of classical interiors, and everybody needed trimmings. And then we go through nowadays into a much more modernist and slimmed down interior. The really elaborate braids and fringes aren't required so much. So you have to slightly think differently about it and what you're going to actually make.
And then next year they could be in fashion and off everybody goes again. Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. And this happens with the companies. I think when I started off, there were maybe about 6 companies in London making trimmings. I think there's only one now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that was the thing about the endangered crafts, and that's come up before with gold work and some of the other more obscure needlework techniques. And to see tassel making, passementerie, I got to practice that, on that list. Are we really at a point? I mean, there were you and 5 others listed as people who are teaching and practicing. Are we really at a point where it's that endangered?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Okay.
I fear that. My fear is that there will be aspects of the whole craft that might disappear. I almost don't want to think about it. But certainly with the cord spinning, if it needs people to be trained. I teach tassels. There's various other people who are teaching. And so I think we're getting somewhere. And of course, the people that we are teaching are not necessarily the people who would have ordered the grand tassels from a trimmings company. So at least the information is being spread and the appreciation of trimmings is now widespread,
yeah.
I think. So, yes, I don't like to think about the future.
Well, it's kind of scary. I mean, we talk to people with all kinds of needlework techniques. I think there are 2 companies making legitimate goldwork thread. And, you know, if they go out of business, you know, we're kind of dead in the water unless you want to buy cheap stuff from Asia. So, you know, it really is concerning because these techniques, we don't want them to go away. They're art.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So do you think that there seems to be a lot of people doing recreation of like clothing anymore? Do you think that might help revive some of these arts because they want their costumes to be authentic?
It depends on the market, doesn't it? It depends on the customers. So yes, you're right. You know, there's some fantastic work being done sometimes for the film or theater industry, or sometimes for people for something that they have a passion about. I've made some wonderful tassels to go onto the back of a jacket of somebody who rides a horse in a particular way. You know, there's always something, isn't there? But with tassels and trimmings, it's again, it's I don't know. Let's just hope. I don't know what the future holds. But I think perhaps more people involved with the recreation of historical dress than there are people who are involved with the recreation of historical trimmings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. True.
So is the of the people in England, in the UK who do tassels, passementerie, is it like a little club? I mean, you guys stay in touch all the time, or is everybody just kind of doing their own thing?
What do we do? I think every now and again we make these concerted efforts to kind of get together, and then we don't, and then we do, and then we don't. We haven't got at this stage an organized sort of a association or organization. And some of the people who are in the trade are semi-retired or retired or whatever. I think the younger people who are coming up, Elizabeth Ashdown, who you mentioned, Libby Ashdown, is recently out of the Royal College of Art, and she's very keen to get us all working together. And I hope it works. It can be... There's a certain amount of secrecy in the work, because, as you can imagine, I think it's a rather old-fashioned way of thinking about it. In the old days, you know, textile manufacturers of all types used to be much more secretive about their production. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, it's changed. I think people are much more interested in making sure that everybody, as many people as possible, see how textiles are made. Claire Hedges, who's another trimmings maker, you know, has on her website, she says, please come and have a look at what I do. And there are local bed and breakfasts that, so you can do workshops with her and stay locally and so on, which is wonderful. So we're not really at the stage between us of forming an association and promoting our stuff. I tell you who is, though, the French. You know, the French have always been brilliant at including the government in promoting traditional French crafts. And a few years ago, I went to Lyon and to Saint-Étienne, and those museums are just fantastic with the machinery in Saint-Étienne, which is specializes in narrow wares, and the Silk Museum in Lyon. And you're usually the only person in the museum, you know, which is very odd. Whereas, you know, in England, if you go to the Victoria and Albert Museum, you know, there with 100 other people.
Right.
But they really promote their cultural craft skills.
Well, and the fact that they still have the machinery, that's fascinating to me. Now, see, if I had known that was there, that would be a place I could drag my husband to, because he's an engineer. And so that would, the machinery itself would interest him. And I'd be interested in.
He'd be fascinated. If you go to Lyon and go to the Tourist Information Center, they give you a sheet with all the workshops that you can visit, and out in the villages as well. It's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Beautiful machinery.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure it is. And see, and when you, because we always look at machinery because I'm married to an engineer and have engineers. But to me, that's part of the interesting thing of the of these textiles is how it was made. You know, how did they make it, you know, years and years ago?
They had in a lot of the French workshops had the much, much, much larger looms where you can weave six, seven, whatever braids side by side. You know, they're very wide, made of chestnut often. So not like me, I weave one at a time. they, it's beautiful machinery. And the workshops are very tall because these looms are huge, very tall. So they have sort of mezzanine floors. Where you can go around. Yeah.
Wow. Yes. Yes. Fascinating.
So basically, in terms of this dying out, there's still plenty of people and machinery to keep it going on a global basis, but but still not a commonplace thing.
No, there's still one or two places. Brian still does a lot of restoration work for the National Trust or English Heritage or whatever. You know, he's a real specialist and can do very, very detailed work, as can Claire. And Libby Ashdown has a much more contemporary approach, which you can see on her website, which is really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And Wendy Cushing also can do both contemporary and classical work. As long as there's another fire at Windsor and all the trimmings have got to be remade, that's what we want.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Yeah. I noticed in the United States there's been a return to, like, in needlepoint, and some of the needlepoint finishing is making tassels. And I have a canvas. And it needs a tassel on it, but it doesn't need like a tassel like I think of as an American or a lay person, just one that you make and you wrap a thread around. It needs something elaborate on it. And but I would never have known how you go about finding those other than at a big shop. But you could make your own. That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, I could learn this skill. The basics of it and then add it to my own needlework, which I find fascinating.
Well, particularly because if you've still got the yarns, you can use the yarns that you've done the needlepoint with mm-hmm. to make the trimmings, and it really works. Whereas if you go to a department store that sells trimmings, you know, the color range is limited.
Right.
But being able to make something that's color matched is such a treat.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're teaching a class, say I complete, well, obviously I have no clue, so want to learn how to do this, is there a lot involved in terms of tools and equipment, or is it really just have some yarn and the wood cores and you can pretty much go after it?
There's a bit of equipment you need.
Okay.
You need to be able to make a warp. So you probably know weavers make long warps to go onto the loom using a warping board or a warping frame. So it's a bit of specialist equipment. You have to have that to make long warps. So multiple threads put together, which you'll reel off your spools. So if I'm teaching a workshop, I usually prepare these warps in advance because so that the people who come onto the workshop are ready to make the tassel itself. And then for spinning cord, if you can use a hand drill and put a cup hook in the end of a hand drill, but that's tricky. If you have a four hook cord twister, and there are various ones that are on the market, then that's brilliant for helping make cords, 2, 3, 4 strand cords, cable cords and whatever. So, and then after that, so those are the two, perhaps the more expensive bits of equipment. And then there's various other bits of equipment that are useful to have, some of which you can knock up yourself, actually, if you're at all good at woodwork.
Yeah.
And so on. But, you know, yes, you need some basic stuff, quite basic.
Yeah. So do we start with cord? Which do I have to learn first? Cord making? I assume I got to be able to make a cord, or there's no way I can make a tassel.
Well, if I'm teaching a workshop, we'll complete a whole tassel in a day.
Oh.
And I'll start off with showing you how to cover the tassel mold. So there are two distinct methods of doing that, which I teach. Then we'll make a skirt, and I will have prepared these bundles of thread together. And then we'll make a suspension cord. So again, if it's a larger tassel, it may be quite a reasonably complex suspension cord. And people who come on the workshop, if they've never done this before, they're a bit bemused. And by the end of the workshop, they're fascinated by what they've achieved, because it's not, they're not crafts that they will have come across in any other textile work. You know, it's quite special. I think button making, you know, in the 18th century and 17th century, when they made silk covered buttons, I mm-hmm. think if anybody's done that, they'll have an idea of some specialist skills that are involved. But otherwise, it's just very specialized.
And the, what there's you have listed on your website 4 different types of tassels. Is it the design? Is it the material that goes into them? I mean, a linen tassel fascinates me. That's just using linen thread. How do these work out?
I do that a lot with workshops. There's a wonderful Swedish company that dyes linen, and the color range is wonderful. So if you're matching up to a fabric, you can always find in this particular set of linen yarns colors that will match. Also, it's a yarn, you've got to have a good weight to the yarn. So when you're making a skirt, the skirt wants to drop and fall nicely. You can't use a knitting yarn, obviously. It's too light and fluffy.
Mm-hmm.
So good heavy yarn. And also commercially made cotton embroidery thread is not expensive and easy to use and comes in a wide range of colours. So we start off with that, either the linen yarn if it's a larger tassel, or the cotton thread if it's a key tassel. And again, so the color, the commercial color ranges are good. So luckily, we've got good starting points with the yarn. And yeah, and then we'll treat the tassel mold first, make the skirt, make a suspension cord, and maybe the whole lot has to go together with a ruff which hides the joining points, and little bits of bindings and so on. All difficult to explain in words, as you can imagine.
Right.
Well, and then the other part I see is, you know, we think of tassels that would go off the end of a bed cover or a jacket or whatever, but then there's also, I've seen enough where people just create a piece of art, just a single tassel that's decorated and trimmed and as its own standalone art.
Yeah, it depends, yes, what your what you need to do for your end product, I suppose, doesn't it? You know, whether you've got to take the fabrics that the tassel is going to be set to into account, or whether you just want to make a tassel, you know, if it's at the end, in the corners of a cushion, you know, the cushion colours are going to be important. But if it's just going to be in the centre of a room or anywhere on a plain wall or whatever, you can go crazy. And some people have done really huge tassels, you know, made a point of making giant tassels for interior decoration fairs or something like that. So again, I kind of think of the tassel as a little bit like a doll, you know, it's a sort of human proportion in as well. So you've got the body of the tassel, you've got the skirt, and you've got the head. So you can make a large one or a small one or any size you like.
Yeah. Everything in your house has a tassel hanging off of it?
No.
Okay.
I love making them and I'm fascinated by them. And I hang them. I do hang them on doorknobs, whatever. I certainly don't have swags and tail curtains. And and my interior, I have to say, I have quite a lot of ethnic textiles in my interior. So I have Turkish and Persian rugs and so on. So that's a completely different way of thinking about it. And then I do hang my tassels everywhere, or I put them in a box.
Seasonal tassels. Yeah.
Seasonal tassels is a good idea. Yes. Yes. Yeah. They're fun. The thing about tassels is that they don't have to have a function at all. And whether they all started from needing to knot up the ends of some woven cloth into some kind of fringing or whatever. I mean, that's always the sort of what one imagines is the starting point. It's just matters on the amount of time that you have in order to elaborate and decorate the textiles that you already have.
So what are you doing these days? Some teaching, just your own creations?
Yeah, I'm semi-retired. I at one stage I was going around sort of chasing work, as one does, taking my work around to interior decorators and so on. But now what I've got is I'm teaching quite a bit, and also I've got just one or two, a few regular customers, an upholsterer who does some beautiful work with very special bits of old furniture, antique furniture, which he's reupholstering, and I'll make various braids and cords for him. And I do quite a lot of altar fringes, actually. So if you think about church altar coverings, there's always beautiful silk fringes on them. So I'll weave up silk fringes for various, and that's all to do with being in touch with people who are volunteer embroiderers at various cathedrals and so on. So I've done work for St. Paul's Cathedral, and I've done work for local churches, you know, that kind of thing. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. And teaching regularly? You have a regular schedule or do you wait till you...
I used to teach regularly foundation art and design in the UK. But what I'm doing now is I have two places, maybe three places where I teach regularly with the tassels and trimmings. West Dean College, which is down at Chichester, which is a beautiful place. And I always recommend to people that if there's anything you do at least once in your life, it's to go to West Dean College. And then there's another place in London where I do just day workshops, Good Life Centre, which is a treat. It's a most lovely place to learn. And a summer school, a five-day summer school I do just outside Cambridge, which is weaving. So that's the only course that I do where we learn to weave. And then I'll go off and teach at local guilds or whatever, you know, one-off classes, but those are the regular places.
Yeah. You guys always get to teach in some of the neatest places because you have those old buildings to go to.
Yes, indeed.
Now, if we want to learn, now you've done two books.
I've done one book.
One book.
I've done one book, which the publisher has, each time they reprint it, they give it a different name.
Okay.
So
all right.
It started off as...
I couldn't sort that out. That was okay.
Yeah, I've done one book. It's had five different names. I did the book in 1996, and it keeps on being reprinted. So it's readily available. But if anybody says to me, I've got all your books, I know that they haven't read them because it's one book. One book. And it's all you need to know.
Yeah, that's funny.
And it's sort of got recipes in, so you can follow the projects easily enough. Some people are really good at following projects from books, but... and some people need to come to a class. I'm always very impressed when people can follow recipes from books. I think it's quite difficult. But with that book, one of the things that I had, which was really good fun, I was teaching some students at Kidderminster College, which used to be the place where you would go to learn carpet design, Kidderminster being the carpet weaving centre in the UK. And they did interior textiles. So we did passementerie as an elective, as a secondary thing. And those students had to be very inventive. They couldn't afford, really smart yarns, silks or whatever, and they probably couldn't afford tassel molds. So they did the most exciting things. They used doorknobs and made tassel molds out of card. And whatever, you'll notice them in there are 10 projects in that book, and they're just delightful, really clever. And then I do just the traditional. So the teaching that I do is based on the traditional practices. That's the main thing.
Keep it alive.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Cord making, is that included in the book then, on how to make the cord? Mm.
There's at the beginning of the book, there's the techniques area, the basic techniques, the basics. Mm-hmm. So it does explain about the cord spinning. It's a little bit difficult to go into it in detail in two dimensions. It's much easier when you see it. So it's there. And a lot of the tassels will have just a single two-strand cord, the smaller tassels. And then some of the larger tassels have more elaborate cords, four-strand, double-spun and plain, just to send you over some technical details. So it is in there. And if you're intrepid, you should be able to work it out.
Got my little mind spinning.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that now I know I just have to buy one book, so that helps.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Because the first two titles I saw, okay, that's the same book. And then the third one, had that great big long title, and it's like, wow, another book. And all the same. No, okay.
Don't be fooled. It's not my fault. And the other thing, there's a cord twister, which I used in the book, and that was made by the husband of an embroiderer, and he was sent off to the garden shed every weekend to make these cord twisters for all her friends. And then he stopped making them. So I got an engineer who makes a cord twister. And that is a really good piece of kit. I'm promoting this, as you can, I mean, I don't mean to promote it, but the point is, I think that I've got a feeling that somebody's making them in the States. There's something called the Bradshaw cord twister. I think somebody's making a four hook twister in the States.
Well, and I have to interrupt you. I'm sorry. But the reason I asked is I just took a tassel making class with one of my guilds, and it was online, and I just got the PDF, and I thought, okay, I just wanted the PDF. So when I had time, I could do the tassel making. And then they started discussing, well, where do you get this? They were looking for a three cord, turner, and they were having problems locating one. So that's why I was curious about this, making the cords, because that was something that came up in the discussion with this guild meeting.
Yeah. Yes. There's various ones on the market. There's two of us in the UK selling them. One of which is called a quipu. I don't know if you know the Peruvian, ancient Peruvian cords were called quipu. That's a four hook twister. And so if you look up, it's K-H-I-P-U. You can see that online. On my website, I've got a shot of the cord twister that my engineer has made for me. And it's cunning, and it's not expensive. It's under £60, and we make them in small batches. So in fact, you know, it's a good price. I don't want to. I'm advertising. I don't need to.
No, that's okay. No, because I wanted to learn about that cord twister. So tell about that four hook. What does four hook mean? Take us through that.
Okay, it's got a drum.
It's okay to promote, really, Anna. It's fine.
Is it okay? So it's got a sort of 4-inch drum which has four hooks coming out of it, and a handle, and a winder, and you press a button on the drum and turn the handle, and the hooks turn round. Then for the counter twist, you take your thumb off that button, and you can twist the strands together. So it means that at one time you can put on two strands for a two strand cord, you can put on three strands for a three strand cord, four strands, whatever, twist them up and ply them together. All done. It's a cunning gadget. I've sell them when I teach, mainly. And my engineer who designed them said, oh, why aren't you putting it on the, you know, sort of selling them all over the world? Well, mainly because I think it helps if you're taught how to use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, my mouth is open now. My mouth is open. See, I have that little hand one that has one hook. So you have to have your husband around or a significant other to hold it, because you have to take it off the hook, have them hold it while you grab it again and twist the other way.
And your husband has got to be an obedient person who listens to what you say and doesn't have an alternative opinion.
Right. And doesn't let go. And doesn't let go. I homeschooled my children, so every now and then I'd have to make a cord or something, and they were home. I'm like, okay, I need two fingers held together, and because, you know, you'd beat all the way across down the hallway making this cording, you know, as far as you could get, and they'd be like, Mom, are you done yet?
And then you've got to keep it taut, haven't you? You've got to keep it under tension.
Right.
And
right.
the children can be hopeless at that unless they're well trained and obedient.
You know, and sometimes, you know, that looks like a way to jump rope or
But yes, certainly on a hand drill, this probably sounds like that's that what you've got, a hand drill with a cup hook in the end.
Yes, right, something like that.
You can certainly do it. It takes more time and it takes a lot of nerve.
So no, this sounds better.
Yeah, your design then gives all the versatility, it sounds like.
It does.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You still have to hold on tight. The trouble can be if you let the tension down when you're twisting up a cord, and then it forms kinks within the cord. Mm-hmm. So
I can see that what got me all excited is that, okay, I can do more than just, because you can hook up a couple of colors, or you can, you know, make one cord and then make another cord and then twist those two together, you know, that I've kind of done. But to be able to do four simultaneously, or even three, is just fantastic.
Yeah. Yes. I don't know if you've ever seen, whether you've got anything in the States, you know, rope walks for shipbuilding. We've got Chatham Docks in the UK, where you can go and watch ships' ropes being made, and they have a cord twister, but it's huge, and it runs on a railway track, and building is a third of a mile long, because that's the length of rope you would need to moor a frigate in, I think, is it 10 fathoms of water? I forget. Anyway, so that's the minimum length. So what we're doing is that on a smaller scale, but often, you know, more elaborate as well, more decorative.
Right.
And I think online you can see lots of images of people making ropes using slightly larger cord twisters. So the principle is there. It takes a bit of skill.
Yeah. Oh, Beth, you got to get one, Beth. You got to get one.
It's already on my list. Yep. Trust me.
If you go onto the website, you'll see there's a way of ordering it.
Right. Yeah. And it just makes me, because if you're doing your own finishing, I do hate going to the big box stores, because you cannot match your fabric or what you want with the thread you've done all this hand stitching on. And it's like, well, this kind of works, you know? And I'm not in a big city, like in Chicago or New York, where there's trimming places. I have to go to a store that just sells a small amount of them. So to be able to match my threads would be a huge difference.
Now that's something that I'll send you, a picture of a needlepoint cushion, which has a cord and tassels in it. So I should send you a picture of that.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a real treat to be able to do that.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
All right, Beth, you need a cord twister. I can tell. Yep. Just tell.
Well, we know. Well, you know, because I finish things, so I need to have a way to trim them up.
Right. Yep. So. Yeah. See, I don't actually finish needlework, so
you start it, but
I'm very good at starting and getting in the middle. Yep. Yes. Very good at that.
Yes.
It's a skill.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of start alongs going. Yes.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. Wow. This is what a fascinating world. Thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for the conversation. It's been fun.
Yep. And thanks for teaching us how to say passementary.
You're welcome.
Check it out. Yeah. All right. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Bye.